And I think that that could be said of Jesus, that he really did disturb those that were comfortable. We noticed last Sunday evening Jesus as the rebel. And we saw how that he sure enough did disturb those that were comfortable in their false religion. And how that perhaps this could be epitomized by the 23rd chapter of Matthew, the chapter on woes, where he simply said, "Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, you hypocrites." And then he spelled out seven woes that cut through those people and laid them bare. And the common people, of course, heard this, and it polarized them. And they were able to see that Jesus really did truly speak with authority, and that these other people were hypocrites. They had suspected it, and Jesus was brave enough and had enough evidence to say it. But he also was one who was a comforter, and that's what we're going to be studying tonight. And I think that that is characterized most clearly by the statement that he issued to the downtrodden, to those that were oppressed by religious hypocrisy and religious burdens that had been laid upon them by pseudo-leaders. And to a downtrodden, discouraged nation of people, Jesus opened his arms and said, "Come to me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart." And so he issued that gentle, reassuring invitation and stands there in that very beautiful stance as one who knocks on our door and says to us, "If anyone will answer, I will come in and I'll eat supper with him." As we looked at the life of Jesus and viewed him from various angles as the storyteller, as the mixer, the social person who was always in people's homes, as we saw him as the physician, healing those who came to him, as the logician, who tied his adversaries in knots and who caused them to just simply swear off ever asking him another question because they always came out on the wrong end of the deal. As we looked at him as rebel, we would have to say that not a single one of these by itself would picture Jesus the whole man. He was not just a storyteller. He was not just a logician or just a physician, or just a social mixer, or just any of these by themselves. And probably he was not just these that we've already mentioned in the totality or the combination of all of these, because what we've already noticed about Jesus is, up to this point, elliptical. It's not complete. And I don't know how mortals would ever be able to describe Jesus in any complete form or fashion. And so we're left to simply marvel and muse at the magnificence of this one whose life is like a spectrum of light as it's focused into the prism of God's revelation. These beautiful and radiant glistenings of light of all different hues are presented for us to gaze at and to marvel at. And that's been the purpose of this series, to let the light of God's revelation through Jesus hit the prism of his word and for us to be able to sit here and marvel in the wonder and the beauty of his life. But if there could be one particular facet of light, if there could be one particular facet of his life that could be identified perhaps more than any other, as more nearly than any other, picturing his real tone of his presence, it would probably be the one we're going to talk about tonight, Jesus the Comforter. Now you might take exception to that and say, "Well, no, that's just your personality seeing him. You just need comforting, and because of the fact that you have this need, you run there and find this in his life." Well, I thought about that. I don't believe that that's true, though. I want to give you several reasons just by introduction to allay that. I don't believe that that's right. I believe that when you get right down to what was the basic, perhaps the ultimate, personality trait that Jesus would have us know Him by, I believe you'll have to come to the conclusion that He would have us know Him as the Comforter. For example, the Beatitudes. The basic tone of the Beatitudes is comfort. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. And he goes on and on until he gets down to where he says, blessed are the persecuted. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall persecute you and revile you and say all manner of evil against you. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. They persecuted the prophets like that, he says, that were before you. So you see the tone of even the very beginning of all of his teachings and the heart and the essence of it, the tone of the mind of Christ as it's revealed in the Beatitudes comes across as being a message of comfort. And the word makarios, which simply says blessedness or the state of being well or the state of well-being, it has this tone of comfort to it. If you were to list all of the I Ams in John's Gospel, you'll find they are qualities that meet human needs. I am the bread of life. Spoken to a hungry person, of course, is good news. That's comfort. He essentially said, I am the water of life, though he doesn't say it in those terms specifically, but he offers living water to those that are athirst. If anyone is thirsty, he says, let him come to me and drink. And to the woman at the well, he said, if you only knew who it was that was speaking to you, you would ask of him and he'd give you living water. When he said, I am the good shepherd, I am the door. By me, if any man enter in, he shall be saved and shall go in and out and find pasture. I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness. I am the vine and you are the branches. And then he issued that sad invitation, or perhaps not an invitation so much as it was a regret. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered your children together like a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not. In all of this, we see that there is this strain of comfort that he offers to the world, and many times people didn't accept it, but nevertheless he was there, standing at the door, knocking, standing with his arms open, saying, come, come to me, and I'll give you rest. Again, if you'll look in Luke, the 4th chapter, verses 18 and 19, as Jesus himself, at the very beginning of his ministry, set the tone of his ministry out of the prophets in the Old Testament. He went to Nazareth one day and they gave him the scroll of the book to read. And he turned to the passage. He did this intentionally. They didn't say, Jesus, read a passage for us and give him the passage. They gave him the scroll and he turned through it until he found this passage in Isaiah. And it described his ministry and he wanted them to know that this is what was to be the characteristic of his ministry, the quality of it. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. Because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and the recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those that are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. And then he sat down. He gave the attendant back this scroll and sat down, and all of the eyes in the synagogue were fastened upon him, Luke says. And then he said this, today, this is fulfilled in your ears. And the tone of that entire prophecy was that here comes a man whose quality is to comfort. Do you know what it is that he called his own spirit, whom he said he was going to send into the disciples? He said, if I go away, I will send him to you. Do you know what it was that he called himself in the form of the Spirit? Not the logician, not even the physician, not the rebel, not even the teacher. He said when he, the Spirit of truth, has come, and he called him the Paraclete, the Comforter, when the Comforter is come. Now there's got to be a meaning to that. There must be some significance to his isolating all the qualities that could have been attached to that Spirit and by which he could have described himself coming in that form to his disciples. There must be some significance to the fact that he isolated this one and called him this, the Comforter. Jesus met those great crises of life. And if you'll read through here, and it began to dawn on me as I looked at him as the Comforter, I was suddenly made aware of the fact that, look, he came face to face with all the various crises of life. And he spoke words of authority by which we would be comforted as we approach these great times in our lives, these great crises, the great valleys of our experience. And he faced them, and such encouraging expressions such as these, when they couldn't get the man that had the palsy the normal way into him, it was the place where Jesus was living. It was his roof they tore up that day. We don't know whether it was his house or whether someone by his just the generosity let him use it, but nevertheless, he was at home. They brought this man. He used this expression. He said, "Take heart, my son. Take heart. Your sins are forgiven." When the woman who was a sinner came into Simon the Pharisee's house, and she wept on his feet and anointed his feet with this ointment and wiped them with her hair and cried. And then Jesus, after having this discussion with Simon, he dismissed the woman and said, "Go in peace. Your faith has saved you. Go on in peace. You're all right. Your faith has saved you." And then there's another one. After he had fed the 5,000, and it was a crisis in his life. He had to make his disciples get in the boat. He went on off, and after having dismissed the crowd, the 5,000, it seems these 5,000 revolutionaries who were there trying to make him their king, John says they were going to do it by force. Jesus was forced to push these people and dismiss them and push his disciples into the boat. They went on across the sea. He dismissed the crowd, went up into the hills to pray, and then later on came walking across the water. Strange incident. Scared the disciples to death. They were terrified, it says, when they saw him. They thought it was a ghost. They believed in ghosts back there. And they cried out in fear. And listen to these words. He says, "Take heart. It is I. Have no fear." He used these three words. "Take heart. It is I. Have no fear." In other words, he really had to work at getting them to keep from just losing all control. He said, "Look, don't get excited. It's I. Have no fear. It's okay. Everything's all right." He was a perennial optimist when it came to encouraging other people. If the man Joseph from Cyprus, I think it was, if he was the, and they nicknamed him Barnabas, the son of exhortation, if Joseph from Cyprus was the son of exhortation, Jesus from Nazareth was the father of exhortation. He was always encouraging people, always giving them something to hope for. Jesus met these great crises. Listen to some of them. The anxiety that people feel over their daily needs. Jesus met that with a statement. He says, "Why are you anxious over what you're going to eat?" Listen to him comfort these people and give them hope so that they won't be anxious, so that they'll not spend their hours in anxiety, wondering and worrying about where the next day's meal is coming from. He said, "I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you shall eat or what you shall drink, nor about your body, what you shall put on. Is not the life more than food and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air. They neither sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not of more value than they? And which of you, by being anxious, can add a cubit to the span of his life? Then why are you anxious about clothing? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I tell you, Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, Will he not much more clothe you, O you of little faith? Therefore, don't be anxious, saying, what are we going to eat, or what are we going to drink, or what are we going to wear? For the Gentiles seek all these things, and your heavenly Father knows that you need all of them. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be yours as well. Therefore, do not be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will be anxious for itself. Let the day's own trouble be sufficient for the day. And with that word of authority, he spoke calmness and serenity into their hearts. And he's been quoted for nearly 2,000 years as the great physician, really knowing what all was about. Just simply saying, just don't be anxious. But look again, as he dealt with them regarding the great adversary, fear. Fear of the physical elements, for one thing. On one occasion, he said, let's go over to the other side of the sea. So they did. They got in a boat. He got up in the bow and went to sleep, one of the records says, on a pillow. And he had to catch it where he could get it, I think. The people were pressing on him so far and so close that I believe that he was trying to just simply get some rest. And so he got on a boat with his disciples and went up in the bow and went to sleep. And as it's possible on that Sea of Galilee, a wind came up suddenly and was beginning to swamp the boat, and the disciples were terrified, and they woke him up and they said, Master, don't you care? We're perishing. We're sinking. And Jesus said, why are you afraid? Where is your faith? And then he just said, peace. Be still. And the winds lay, and the waters were calm. And the men looked at him and said, who in the world is this that even the winds and the waves obey him? And he spoke calm on that very tempestuous occasion. But not just fear of the elements. People are made fearful of the evil forces that are around about them. Are you scared? Are you afraid? Do you find yourself cringing at the thought of what's going to happen to you? I've had people tell me, be sure that you lock all your doors as you go to this place and go there, and make sure that you don't get out at night, and all of these, and it may very well be that something will happen. But Jesus taught his disciples, don't be afraid. He was over across the River Jordan as he was toward the latter part of his life, about the last two or three weeks prior to his being crucified. And they'd just been trying to kill him. And they had gone over there to get away from it because the time wasn't right yet. But then someone sent a message. Mary and Martha sent a message about Lazarus and said, Lazarus is sick, come quickly. And he waited two or three days and then went. So he said, we're going to go back into Judea. And the disciples said, Lord, they were just now trying to stone you. And you're going to go back in there again? He said, are there not 12 hours in a day? If a man walks in the daytime, he doesn't stumble because the light is in him. But if he walks at night, he can't see where he's going. And he so instilled confidence in these fearful men that Thomas said, well, let's just go and die with him. We're ready to go and die with him. And so he instilled this confidence in them. But there were other areas probably that were more important than these that I've just mentioned. The area of the guilt of sins, how he brought peace and how he brought comfort to those people who were burdened with sins. You know the story, and I've told it so many times I find myself embarrassed, and I'll not repeat it tonight except just to tell about the woman who was taken in adultery and the kind gesture that Jesus made toward her as he dismissed her accusers, and as she then stood there in the midst of all this crowd of people and he just asked her, dear lady, where are your accusers? Do you have none? She said, no, Lord. He said, neither do I condemn you. You go on now and don't sin again. And he allowed her to regain some of her feeling of being right with God. And he dismissed her, letting her know that he knew she sinned, but he just forgave her. And he had that right. And then on one occasion, Simon Peter came up to Jesus, feeling him out about what his attitude was toward forgiving people. And he said, sir, how many times should I forgive my brother if he sins against me? Seven times? I think the law had prescribed four. But Peter was being extra generous, and he was going to go three more times. He said, seven times? And listen to this attitude of Jesus toward forgiveness of people. He said, "Oh, Simon, not seven times. I tell you, 70 times seven." In other words, just countless times. But the thing that communicated was not the number. It was the attitude that Jesus had toward poor sinners. When he just told Simon, "Simon, keep on forgiving them." And he couldn't have told Simon that had he himself not been acting in that same way. Simon got an indication here as to what the mind of Jesus was towards sinners. How the guilt began to melt away from those whose lives had been simply intimidated to the point of total frustration. Because everywhere they turned, they were guilty of sin. Every direction, everything that they did, everything about their lives, someone was always pointing a bony finger, saying, you're doing wrong. And I know they must have been so overjoyed at the prospect of having someone over them who could lift this burden of guilt from them. I see it at its very apex in the life of the thief on the cross, and how he freed this man and comforted him and told him, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." And he used up that energy that could have been very well preserved by comforting and consoling this man who really didn't have any reason to ask for mercy. "Today you'll be with me in paradise." There's a strange passage in John, the 16th chapter. I don't really quite know what it means, but it's unusual. I'd like to just mention it to you. In John, the 16th chapter, verses 32 and 33, they had been talking. Jesus had been talking about his going away and that he was going to, they'd miss him, and then he'd come back again, and their sorrow would be turned into joy. But then in verse 29, they claimed to know and understand that Jesus was the Christ. And they said, "Now we believe that you're from God." And he looked at them, perhaps pensively, and said, "Do you really believe? Do you really believe?" He said, "The hour is coming and already is here when each one of you will forsake me. You'll go to your own homes and you're going to leave me alone. But then listen to this verse. But I'm not alone, for the Father is with me." And then verse 33 says, "I have said this to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world." I don't understand what he means there. It may mean that he's talking about he said this to them about his going and coming. Or it may be that he's simply telling them in an attempt to prepare them to deal with the guilt that was going to come upon them as they forsook him. Perhaps he was even at this point trying to get them ready for the disappointment in themselves that they were going to experience when he says, "You're going to leave me. You're going to all forsake me." But as though to say, "That's all right. It's all right. My Father's with me. I'm not alone. My Father's with me." And he said, "Now I'm telling you this so that you'll be able to be at peace in yourselves. You're going to have trouble in the world, but in me you have peace." And he says, "Be of good cheer. I've overcome the world." But the point, and whatever's the reason that he says it, for whatever purpose it may be, I do want you to see that this man, even at the hour when the cross was weighing heavily upon his own back and the shadow of it had already overtaken him, he was involved in encouraging other people. He said, "Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. Don't worry. Everything's going to be all right." Well, there are other things. The self-worth and people's self-image. You know, poor people, or I say poor people, that's not true. People who have a poor image of themselves, perhaps people who are those who are less fortunate than others, sometimes have difficulty with their self-image. But it's not restricted to people who are less fortunate in the physical things, but it sometimes does affect them. Jesus dealt with this, and whoever it may be that felt like they were on the outside looking in, Jesus made some comments. There was a man once that stood up that someone had wronged financially. His brother had gypped him out of some money. And it was eating upon the man. He didn't hear anything Jesus said. He interrupted Jesus, stood up in the crowd and said, "Make my brother give me my part of the inheritance." And Jesus simply said, "Man, who made me a judge or a ruler over you? He said, be careful now and don't have anything to do with covetousness. He said, a man's life doesn't depend on the amount of his possessions. A man's life, or life really doesn't, is not involved with how much you've got in the bank, or how much you may possess in the way of earthly possessions. It's just not there. Think what that did for the person who didn't really have much confidence in his own worth. He didn't have much money. He didn't have much of the in things. Think about all the common people that must have been encouraged by Jesus and comforted when they realized that their worth just didn't depend upon how much money they had. You remember the day that the widow was in the line and they were coming by the coffer in the temple and all these people were giving rich gifts and they were giving of their abundance, and here came this little widow, probably an old one, and she put in just two little copper coins. Jesus saw that. And he said, do you see that widow? He said, she's put in more than all the rest of these have put in, because they've contributed out of their abundance. This woman, out of her poverty, has given all of her wealth. Her whole life, her whole living, he says, she's contributed. And he immortalized that woman and comforted all those widows and everybody else that just don't have much to give. He says to them, you're giving more than all others when you give out of your poverty. And then there was the man that represents so many of us who went up to the temple to pray. And another man who went up there was a Pharisee. He had it all together, he thought. The publican didn't. He knew he was lost. He knew he didn't have a chance. But he confessed God his untogetherness. And then Jesus just simply said, this man went home justified rather than the other. How it must have comforted those people who were excluded by the religious people, knowing that Jesus understood. And then death. Jesus met this obstacle head on. And this somber guest will visit every one of us here tonight. You don't know when he's coming, but he'll be there. He'll stand either over the bed of one of your children, or over the bed of a brother or a sister. He'll stand over the bed of your loved one, your husband or your wife. How are you going to deal with it? Jesus brought comfort, and he brings comfort. Oh, he went to the home of Mary and Martha. Lazarus had been dead for 4 days by the time he got there. But he went there, and he stood with them and stood by them. He talked with them, gave some not shallow comments, but just talked with them and said, your brother's going to live again. And he allowed them to unload on him and say, Lord, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And he just simply said, I know, but your brother will live again. And she said, I know he will in the resurrection. And then a few minutes later, they made their way on toward the tomb, and some of the other Jews from Jerusalem went with them, and Mary was summoned by her sister, and they all went toward the tomb. And Jesus said he was burdened, he grieved in spirit. And they looked up, and some of them saw him crying. And they said, look how he loved him. He was there as a friend. But the most significant thing that he said during that interview was when Martha said, I know that he'll be raised in the resurrection. Then Jesus gave this great jewel that's lived all down through the thousands of years. He said, I am the resurrection and the life. He that believes on me, though he die, yet shall he live again. And he who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said, yes, Lord, I believe. But she didn't really realize what she was saying, because shortly they went to the grave, he rolled back the stone, and he shouted, Lazarus, come out of there! And the dead man was raised. He came out hopping, perhaps in those bandages as they impeded his progress. And he told them, unwrap him and let him go. What a comfort he was in the face of death. In the face of the unknown, Jesus prepared them for what was to come that they couldn't understand. In John 14:1, he said, let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. In my Father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, would I not have told you? And when I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again to take you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. And you know the way where I'm going. Thomas said, Lord, we don't know where you're going. How can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Then later on, that in the 16th chapter, in that same night, really, Jesus talked to them about how that they would be sorrowful for a few days. He said, I'm going to go away and you won't see me anymore, but then I'm coming again and you'll see me again. He said, the world is going to be, they're going to rejoice and you're going to be sorrowful, like a woman that's giving birth to a child. But he said, your sorrow will be turned to joy and nobody will ever be able to take it away from you. And then after his resurrection, Luke records how he materialized in their presence as they were talking behind closed doors. And Jesus then, obviously seeing their fear, but they were startled and frightened and supposed that they saw a spirit. And he said to them, why are you troubled? And why do questionings arise in your hearts? See my hands and my feet, that it is I myself. Handle me and see. For a spirit has not flesh and bones, as you see that I have. And while they still disbelieved for joy and wondered, listen to him as he condescends. He said, do you have anything here to eat? And looked around and found some fish that had been broiled. And he took it and condescended now to, in a sense, re-enter their area and their sphere. And he took it and ate it as evidence that he was really and truly there. And he told them, you must not be afraid. And he took it and ate it before them. Well, it's unusual. He gave so much, and he received so little from people here on earth. He didn't even have the normal comforts as we think of them, a home and family. He replied once to a man that said, I'll follow you wherever you go. He said, foxes have holes and birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. As one who had so few of the comforts of life, he stood up like a great giant rock under whose shadow and in whose protection not only his 12 and not only those who were outside the number of the 12 took refuge, but under whose protection how many thousands and how many countless millions of people from that time until this have gotten beneath the rock of ages and have found comfort there. Jesus said, in the world you have tribulation, but don't worry. I've overcome the world. And then he took them outside up into a mountain out in Galilee and gave them that beautiful statement when he said to them, now go on and preach the gospel to the whole creation. He said this. He said, look, I'm going to be with you forever, even to the end of the world. Jesus, the great comforter. I can't think of an attribute or a description that's more appropriate than to look upon this great one who came and offered himself and extended the invitation and just simply stood there as the great comfort of the human race. It's amazing to me how we can know him, think we can know him, or think we do know him, and then when times of distress come and times that are ridden with anxiety and times that would produce fear in us and when death threatens us and when all of these things of self-worth or the feelings of guilt and whatever, when all of these great crises of life threaten our lives, for us to not understand that that's why he came. He came to give those who were downtrodden some freedom, to release the captives, to give sight to the blind, to preach good news to the poor. This was his work, Jesus the Comforter. You may need tonight to talk to someone. You may be having a burden and you're carrying it on you so heavily that somebody will have to help you see Jesus Christ and how it applies. It may be that you've already seen how it applies tonight, and you can be free. You can rid yourself of all those burdens that He came to rid you of. You may need to respond and come forward and ask for help, whatever may be your need. Realize this one thing, that the one attribute of all the others, perhaps of that He would single out and say, this is what I want you to remember me as. I want you to remember me as your comforter. And so He simply extends the invitation, come to me, all ye that labor and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Would you come right now while we stand and sing?